All right, welcome everyone to another deep dive. Today we're taking a look at Ralph Nader v. John Keith,
a Seventh Circuit case from 2004.
Yeah, and you know, on the surface, it might just seem like some obscure legal precedent, but
it goes deeper than that.
Yeah, it's really about how states try to walk this fine line, you know, like who gets on the ballot.
Exactly.
And especially what it means for independent candidates who are kind of trying to shake things up a bit.
Right. Trying to change the system.
Yeah. And I think this deep dive is going to be really useful for anyone who wants to like wrap their head around those big concepts in election law.
The core principles at play.
Exactly. And we've got a bunch of materials to help us out here. You know, we've got the podcast guidance that breaks down the whole decision. We've got a really in-depth case brief, a more like standard summary, and even, get this, a perplexity analysis.
Oh, wow. A perplexity analysis. That's
yeah. To sort of help us see all the little details, all the nuances of Nader v. Keith.
I'm very interested to hear about this perplexity analysis.
Yeah.
What is a perplexity analysis?
Yeah, we'll get into it. It's interesting. It's kind of a way of measuring how surprising or unpredictable the language in a text is.
Interesting. So like it's applied to legal cases in this instance.
Yeah, exactly. You can kind of think of it as like a gauge for how complex or unusual a legal argument is.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm definitely eager to see how that all ties into our deep dive here.
Yeah, and you know what I think is really cool is that like all these different perspectives we have, the briefs, the analysis, they all come together on the central question of ballot access.
Right.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, that's what we're really talking about here, ballot access.
Exactly. So, you know what? Why don't we start by setting the stage? We're in 2004. It's a presidential election year. And Ralph Nader, a pretty well-known guy, decides to run as an independent.
Right. Not affiliated with any major party.
Right. Exactly. So he's got to navigate all these rules and regulations just to get his name on the ballot. So tell us, like, what were some of the specific hoops he had to jump through in Illinois?
So in Illinois, back in 2004, if you were an independent presidential candidate like Nader, you had to collect a minimum of 25,000 valid signatures.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of signatures.
It is, yeah. And not just any signatures. These had to be from registered Illinois voters.
Okay, so already we're seeing that there's a bit of a bar there, you know, not just anyone can sign.
Absolutely. And there's another catch, another really important detail. The address that each person put down on that petition when they signed, it had to perfectly match the address on their voter registration.
Oh, wow. So even a slight discrepancy could invalidate the signature.
Precisely. And to add another layer of complexity, there was a hard deadline. All these petitions had to be submitted a whopping 134 days before the election, which that year fell on June 21st.
June 21st. So tell me, did Nader's campaign manage to collect all those signatures in time?
They did. They actually filed over 32,000 signatures. I think they felt pretty good about that, you know, a good buffer over the requirement.
Yeah, they must feel pretty confident.
Yeah, but then the State Board of Elections, they go through all these submissions, and more than 19,000 signatures were challenged.
19,000? Wow, what were the grounds for those challenges?
The main reason, and this ties into what we were talking about earlier, was that address mismatch.
Uh-huh, that strict address matching rule.
Exactly. If the address on the petition didn't align perfectly with the voter registration records, it was flagged. And ultimately, over 12,000 signatures got tossed out. Deemed invalid.
So he ends up way below that 25,000 mark.
Yeah, he doesn't make the cut. And that essentially meant his name wouldn't appear on the ballot in Illinois.
That's a huge blow for any campaign. So, you know, it's interesting because the podcast guidance we have, it points out that this wasn't Nader's only legal battle at the time.
Right. It's important to remember that this federal lawsuit, the one we're focusing on, was happening at the same time as a separate case in Illinois state court.
Two legal fronts.
Exactly. And get this. Both lawsuits were challenging these same ballot access rules. So it was like a double-barreled legal attack.
Wow. A two-pronged approach. So let's zero in on the federal case for our deep dive. Can you tell us exactly what Nader was asking the federal court to do?
Okay, so in the federal court, what Nader wanted was something called a preliminary injunction.
Okay, break that down for us. What exactly does that mean?
A preliminary injunction, it's basically like a temporary order from the court. In this case, what Nader was asking for was for the court to force Illinois to put his name on the ballot, even though technically he didn't hit that magic number of signatures.
So kind of like a legal workaround.
Exactly. And this kind of thing, this preliminary injunction, it's usually requested when someone believes they're going to suffer some serious irreversible harm if the court doesn't step in.
And being excluded from the ballot, that's definitely a major setback for any candidate.
Right. I mean, it essentially shuts you out of the entire race in that state.
Makes sense. So what were the main legal arguments that Nader's team put forward in this federal challenge? Like, what constitutional rights did they claim were being violated by these Illinois rules?
The heart of their argument was that the combination of these requirements, the 25,000 signature minimum, that really strict address matching rule, and the early filing deadline, all of that together, they argued, created an unconstitutional burden.
A burden on who, exactly?
Well, they said it violated the First Amendment rights of voters, specifically their right to freely associate with a candidate and cast their vote for whomever they choose.
Okay, so affecting voters' ability to support their candidate of choice.
Exactly. And they also argued that it violated Nader's own 14th Amendment right to equal protection under the law.
Because it put him at a disadvantage compared to candidates from established parties.
Exactly. They argued that these rules essentially made it way too hard for independent candidates, who often lack the kind of big money and infrastructure of the major parties, to even have a shot at getting their name in front of voters.
Right, because they don't have the same resources to gather signatures and navigate all these complex rules.
Right. It's kind of like a David versus Goliath situation.
So we have this clash between, on one hand, protecting the integrity of elections, and on the other hand, ensuring that everyone has a fair chance to participate in the political process. How do courts typically approach these kinds of situations where we have competing interests at play?
It's a tricky balance. Luckily, there's a legal framework for analyzing these kinds of election law challenges. It's called the Anderson v. Celebrez balancing test, and it's a core concept in our sources.
Okay, I've heard of that case, but remind us, how does this balancing test actually work?
It's pretty straightforward. Courts are supposed to weigh the burden that a state's election laws impose on those fundamental rights of voters and candidates we were just talking about. The right to vote, the right to associate, the right to equal protection.
Okay, so those are on one side of this.
Well, some common ones are making sure elections run smoothly and efficiently, preventing voter fraud, and keeping the ballot from getting too cluttered with, you know, candidates who maybe aren't serious contenders.
Okay, so the state wants to make sure that only candidates who have a reasonable level of support are on the ballot.
Right. It's about balancing access with ensuring a certain level of order and legitimacy in the process.
So taking all of that into account, what did Nader need to demonstrate to convince the Seventh Circuit to issue that preliminary injunction? What were the specific legal hurdles he had to clear?
There are actually four main criteria for getting a preliminary injunction. First, he had to show that he was likely to win his case.
So not just that he had a grievance, but that he had a strong legal argument that the Illinois rules were actually unconstitutional.
Exactly. Then second, he had to prove that he would suffer irreparable harm if the injunction wasn't granted. And as we said before, being excluded from the ballot, that definitely qualifies as irreparable harm in most cases.
Right, because once the election is over, you can't really go back and fix that.
Exactly. Then the third factor, the court had to look at something called the balance of equities. Basically, they weigh the potential harm to Nader if they deny the injunction against the potential harm to the state of Illinois if they grant it.
So kind of like, who would be worse off if the court ruled against them?
Yeah, it's about figuring out where the greater harm lies. And finally, the court has to consider whether granting the injunction would be in the public interest.
Okay, so they're looking at the broader implications for the electoral process and for voters in general.
Precisely. And the interesting thing is, in Nader v. Keith, the Seventh Circuit, they put a lot of weight on two of these factors: the likelihood of success on the merits and the balance of equities.
And they really zeroed in on the timing of Nader's lawsuit, right?
Yes, the timing played a huge role in their decision.
Okay, so let's break down how the court tackled each of those specific requirements that Nader was challenging. What was their take on that 25,000 signature requirement? Was it too high a bar for an independent candidate to clear?
So the court, and this was Judge Posner writing the opinion, they didn't really see that 25,000 signature threshold as being all that unreasonable.
Especially in a presidential election.
Right. They pointed out that it was only about half of 1% of all the registered voters in Illinois at the time.
So not a huge percentage of the electorate?
Not at all. Mm. And they also brought up Illinois' history with election fraud. Apparently, there'd been some issues in the past, so the court kind of gave them a pass for having stricter rules compared to some other states.
So they acknowledge that different states might have different levels of concern about voter fraud, and that could justify some variation in their rules.
Exactly. But the bottom line was, in this case, the court basically said, look, asking an independent candidate to get signatures from half of 1% of registered voters, that's not an outrageous demand.
Especially when you're talking about a presidential election, you're not just trying to get on the ballot for, you know, city council or something.
Right. It's the highest office in the land. So the court felt like that requirement struck a decent balance between giving people access to the ballot and preventing frivolous candidacies.
Okay, that makes sense. What about that strict address matching rule? I mean, that seems like it could really trip people up.
Yeah, that was a big point of contention. The court acknowledged that this rule could potentially make things harder for certain groups of voters.
Yeah.
You know, people who are low income, people who move around a lot.
Who might be less likely to keep their voter registration perfectly up to date.
Exactly. But even so, Judge Posner called it a reasonable anti-fraud measure. Their thinking was, if someone isn't actually registered to vote at the address they put down on a petition, then that raises some red flags about whether that signature is legit.
So it's about ensuring that the people signing those petitions are who they say they are and that they're eligible to vote in that election?
Precisely. And the court also pointed out something interesting about Nader's campaign specifically. They said, look, your guy announced his candidacy back in February. You had months to gather signatures and verify addresses.
So they were suggesting that if they'd been more diligent, they could have avoided a lot of these invalidations.
Yeah, that was their point. They weren't saying the rule itself was perfect, but they were saying that Nader's campaign didn't do enough to comply with it.
That's a good point. It highlights that even with these rules in place, campaigns still have a responsibility to run a tight ship and make sure they're following the letter of the law.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it speaks to that tension we were talking about earlier, the balance between this state's duty to protect the integrity of elections and the campaign's responsibility to do their due diligence.
Right. So what about that 134-day deadline? That seems pretty early, doesn't it? Like, why did Illinois need all that time to process the signatures?
So Illinois argued that this early deadline was crucial for them to do their job properly. They said they needed enough time to review all those petitions, verify the signatures, deal with any challenges that come up, and basically make sure everything is settled before the actual election rolls around.
So basically they're saying, look, we need time to dot our I's and cross our T's.
Exactly. And the court found that argument pretty convincing, especially since Nader's lawsuit wasn't actually challenging the process itself. He wasn't saying that the review process was unfair or biased or anything like that.
So by not contesting the process, he was implicitly accepting that it would take some time.
Right. And the court basically said, well, if you're not challenging the process itself, then 134 days seems like a reasonable amount of time for the state to get everything done.
It sounds like the court was pretty deferential to the state's judgment on that point. They weren't second-guessing the state's assessment of how much time they needed.
Exactly. It was all about balance. They acknowledged that the deadline was early, but they also recognized that Illinois had legitimate reasons for needing that time to administer the election properly.
Okay, so let's talk about a factor that seems like it was really key in this case. The timing of Nader's lawsuit. Why was that such a big deal for the Seventh Circuit?
It all comes down to the principle that courts generally try to avoid rocking the boat too close to an election.
They don't want to cause chaos or confusion for voters or election officials.
Exactly. And in this case, Nader waited until late June to file his federal lawsuit. That was right around the deadline for submitting those petitions.
But he'd already been campaigning for months.
Right. He announced his candidacy back in February. And Judge Posner, he was pretty blunt about it. He called this delay gratuitous. Basically, he was saying that Nader didn't have a good excuse for waiting so long.
So the court was thinking, if you'd filed the suit earlier, we might have been more sympathetic.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But coming in at the last minute, it just didn't look good. The court was really worried about the potential for disruption. I mean, imagine if they'd granted the injunction and ordered Illinois to put Nader on the ballot at that late stage.
It could have thrown everything into disarray.
Yeah.
They might have had to reprint ballots, reconfigure voting machines, and who knows what else.
It would have been a logistical nightmare. And all of this was happening when they were already starting to prepare absentee ballots.
So it wasn't just a theoretical concern, it was a real practical problem.
Absolutely. And that concern about disrupting the election process, that was a major strike against Nader in the court's eyes.
It underscores a key lesson for anyone involved in election law. Time is of the essence. If you're going to challenge something, you've got to do it early.
Right. Don't wait until the 11th hour. The later you wait, the less likely a court is to intervene, especially if it could jeopardize the smooth running of the election.
Makes sense. Now, there's one more point I want to touch on. The court also brought up the fact that even after all those signatures were invalidated, Nader was still well short of that 25,000 target.
Right. Even with the invalid signatures, he was only at around 20,000.
So the court basically said, look, even if we gave you the benefit of the doubt on some of these rules, you're still not close to meeting the requirement.
Exactly. They implied that maybe the rules weren't the only problem here.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there just wasn't enough genuine support for Nader's candidacy in Illinois to begin with.
So they're casting doubt on whether he would have qualified even with a lower threshold.
Right. They basically said, look, even if we tweak these rules a bit, there's no guarantee you would have made it.
It's a tough message, but it's a reality check for independent candidates. You can't just rely on legal challenges to get on the ballot. You need to build a solid base of support.
Absolutely. You need to demonstrate that there's a real constituency out there that wants you on the ballot.
Okay, so taking a step back and looking at the big picture, what are the main takeaways from Nader v. Keith? What does this case teach us about the legal landscape for independent candidates and the way courts approach these kinds of challenges?
I think the biggest lesson here is that courts are walking a tightrope. On one hand, they recognize that independent candidates face an uphill battle. They don't have the same resources and advantages as the major parties.
Right.
But on the other hand, courts also recognize that states have a legitimate interest in regulating their elections.
And making sure that the process is fair and orderly.
Exactly. And as Judge Posner said in this case, the barriers to third parties must not be set too high. But at the same time, he and the rest of the court felt that Illinois' rules, while strict, didn't cross that line.
So they were saying, yeah, these rules are tough, but they're not unconstitutional.
Right. It's a delicate balance. And in this case, the court sided with the state.
And the timing of the legal challenge, that was clearly a major factor in their decision.
Absolutely. Nader v. Keith is a stark reminder that when it comes to election law, timing is everything. The closer you get to the election, the less likely a court is to intervene, especially in a way that could disrupt the process.
Because at that point, the potential harm to the state and to voters outweighs the harm to the candidate.
Exactly. And that's something that any candidate or group thinking about challenging election laws needs to keep in mind. Don't wait until the last minute.
It's also interesting that the fact that there was a parallel state court case going on didn't seem to affect the federal court's decision.
Right. The Seventh Circuit went ahead and made its own ruling without waiting to see what the state court would do.
Which suggests that federal courts won't always defer to state courts in these types of cases.
Exactly. Even if there's a similar case pending in state court, a federal court might decide to forge ahead with its own analysis, especially if there are federal constitutional issues at stake.
So what's the bottom line for someone who's thinking about running as an independent candidate or maybe challenging ballot access laws? What are the key things they need to know based on this case?
Well, the first thing is these laws are complicated and they can vary a lot from state to state. So do your homework, figure out what the rules are in your state, and make sure you understand them.
Right. Don't just assume that what applies in one state will apply everywhere.
Exactly. And the second thing is, be prepared to act fast. If you're going to challenge a law, don't wait.
The early bird gets the worm.
Exactly. And finally, build a strong base of support. Show the courts, show the state that you have a genuine following, that there are people out there who want to see you on the ballot.
Because ultimately, that's what it's all about. It's about giving voters a choice.
Exactly. It's about ensuring that our democracy is truly representative and that everyone has a fair shot at participating in the political process.
Well, this has been a fantastic deep dive into Nader v. Keith. It's a really important case, and it offers a lot of insights into the challenges and complexities of running for office as an independent candidate.
Agreed. And it raises some really thought-provoking questions about how we balance those competing interests, the need to protect the integrity of elections, and the need to ensure that everyone has a voice.
And on that note, I'd like to leave our listeners with a final thought. Think about what we've discussed today about the balance struck in this case. What implications do you think these kinds of ballot access regulations have for the long-term health of our democracy? Do they make it harder for new voices and new ideas to break through? Or are they necessary to prevent chaos and ensure fair elections? And what would you say constitutes an unreasonable burden on ballot access? How should courts approach that question in future cases? It's something to ponder as we all continue to engage with the legal and political systems that shape our society. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.